CliffCentral.com.
All right. It is Friday morning. It's the 19th of August, and it is a beautiful day. It's looking like it's going to be a chilly but lovely weekend. Everybody's excited about that. Let us know what you're up to, and give us a shout on the YouTube comments. Also, email us if you've got anything that you want us to cover, any ideas, any guests that you'd like us to have, any people that you feel would make a valuable contribution. You can do that by emailing contact@cliffcentral.com. So, Ben, you're off to Australia, and you're going to be doing one of those serious long-haul flights.
So long.
What is your plan for keeping yourself alive and entertained over the long-haul flight?
So it's currently 3:03 in Melbourne at the moment, in afternoon. So I'm trying to obviously work towards acclimatizing towards that. Mm-hmm. So I think the best thing to do, the first flight is going to be SA Singapore, which I should try sleep in. But you know, like when you, like I haven't had a long haul flight since I went to go visit Hi Rob like 3 years ago. And I'm still an absolute kid when it comes to travel. I like to watch a movie. I like to have like three beers. You know, like that three beer buzz, which is like the best buzz to watch a movie. And then sort of like, you know, but like watch like shit movies. Like you watch, I don't know, whatever the latest Marvel thing is, or you watch a rom-com.
Right.
You're sitting there, like you're going somewhere. It's cool because you can never sleep properly. And I just realized now I just forgot my neck pillow at home. Oh, idiot.
Are you going straight from the office?
Yeah, I'm going straight from here. The idea is
you can just buy those things at the airport. They're not really expensive.
But I've got like four already because I've done that before. Forget buy. It's kind of like those Woolworths shopping bags. That's what I have with neck pillows. the idea is to try and get some sleep between here and Singapore. But then from Singapore to Melbourne, like that's another 8 hours. And then I get to Melbourne 8 o'clock Saturday. Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And also, whenever you travel east, you kind of lose time, and it feels like it feels almost as if you've been cheated out of a couple of hours, which is true. You have on the clock. It's easy to fly west. When you fly west, you don't feel so grumpy about it, and you gain time, so you end up getting there sometimes without losing it a day at all.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a pretty exciting prospect that there's been quite a lot of hard work to make sure we're prepared for this trip. And I just want to go and be somewhere else for a bit.
Do you ever do sleeping pills on a flight?
No, I'm not big on taking any sort of medication unless I really, really have to. I don't like to tamper with what I'm trying with my body ever.
Well, Congo Chris, talking about your body, he is most concerned with constipation. So he has this advice. Don't have beers, have Bloody Marys on a long flight. Jet lag is bad, but long flight constipation is much worse. A Bloody Mary solves that problem. Well, that's some useful info. I've never had long flight constipation. I'm sorry to hear about that.
Well, it's interesting here because, well, you get people who go away and like they can never make a poo because they're not comfortable. Yeah, it's a big thing. So like hydration, dehydration is a massive thing when you travel. You've got to try and move a little bit. You know, obviously as you get older, you got to worry about these things. And if you can't have a poo for like 2 days, that's not good for you, especially with the kind of food that you're eating. You know, it's like I have a very healthy regime, which is really good. My body functions well. Now I'm going to go into a position where I'm not going to probably eat as well for 2 whole weeks. That's shitty.
Well, that's also when you travel, you can't be a stickler for what kind of food you're going to have, because also you're going to go out for dinner a couple of times. You're not going to have necessarily the sort of food that you're used to back home. I mean, Australian cuisine, if there is such a thing, is – I don't want to be rude about them now. But if there is such a thing as Australian cuisine, it's probably not that different to ours, right? I mean, I don't think we eat very, very different things.
No, and like I'm in Melbourne, and Melbourne's probably a bit fancier than most places in Australia.
Yeah, Melbourne apparently is the restaurant capital of Australia, if not one of the best cities in the world to eat out in. I remember friends of mine who'd been there saying it's just absolutely amazing. And there's such variety there. So I don't think you're going to be too tortured. And then you're doing Brisbane as well, right?
Yeah, 3 days in Brisbane, which is apparently just Margate, basically. It's just like
Margate.
Margate, yeah.
I've heard much nicer things said about the Gold Coast than that.
I mean, there's
Yeah. And you're not doing Sydney at all. Have you done Sydney before in a previous trip?
Never. I mean, I live in Illovo, so I don't think going to Sydney is going to be much different for that. It's just sort of old
God,
goose people.
these comparisons. So basically, according to you, Sydney's like Illovo in Johannesburg. Brisbane is like Margate. What are you expecting Melbourne to be like?
Cape Town with more beards. No, it's going to be cold. Hey? It's exactly like Cape Town. It's on the same latitude, I think. So it's going to be rough for like end of winter.
Are you going to interview any bogans?
No, this is very much like I'm presenting and pitching. That's another reason why
Okay.
I never shave. I'm kind of like a
No.
dose on stage.
Yeah, of course. Okay, so Tracy has some useful info here. She says, apart from being quite expensive, Australian food is great. I love the Melbourne vibe. Beautiful place. Yeah, it's apparently what really is just a first class city. So there we go. Tracy says Brisbane is like Miami. So get it right there. And Ben used to work with a guy with a shy bladder. Oh, sorry, not Ben, but Corona's boring. We used to work with a guy with a shy bladder. He was a bit of a dick, so people would whisper, "What's taking him so long?" outside the toilet door and clear out as soon as it flushed. So mean. That is so mean. And yeah, there are lots of useful tips here for you on what it's going to be like in Australia. So do let us know once you're back what it. I'm pretty sure you're not going to be because of the time zone difference. You're not going to be able to talk to us from there. So we'll wait to catch up with you when you get back.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, if I'm free on a Friday at like 2:30, then sure, I'm all in. But
Yeah, I mean,
I'm not entirely sure with our schedule.
yeah, and it's not like you're going to a third world country or anything where you should have internet, right?
Here's hoping. Here's hoping. Yeah, staying in an apartment, which should have good Wi-Fi, and then we're going to be at this. Yeah, like we'll be in civilized, built-up places.
All right. Sounds good. It sounds very good. Just one other quick thing before you go. You seem to have been a bit late to this party, but you didn't notice that Mandela Day came and went in the month of July, and we're already in August. Did this suddenly occur to you over the week?
I was thinking about it recently. Yeah, like whatever happened to Mandela Day? It was clearly I've forgotten about it. I didn't bring it up during the time. But wasn't this like a really big deal? I thought at one stage it was a public holiday, but clearly not.
Yeah, I actually mentioned that there was a company doing an event, and I happened to be in a meeting, and this one guy was like, "Oh, but you know, the 18th of July is Mandela Day; it's a public holiday." And everyone around the table kind of had to check their diaries to make sure that was or wasn't the case. It isn't the case, and you're right; like it just sort of went by this year. I don't think anybody made a big fuss. I didn't see a whole lot of people posting their 67 minutes. So yeah, I think it's maybe. The oxygen's out of the room with that one.
Yeah, it's this whole thing of like this day will make us become better people and give back and all this kind of stuff. But even like the corporates, because again, it's like, is it now cultural appropriation for a corporate to do Mandela Day?
Well, it was a very competitive thing because if you didn't do something, then it was shameful. It used to be that, that these big companies felt bad and were made to feel bad. If they didn't do something for Mandela Day, but I don't think this year there was any of that pressure at
Yeah,
all.
I remember that like last year even. And do you remember that thing, the CEO sleep out? Even that was then deemed offensive.
Yeah, that was a problem because then they were what by going out and staying in a sleeping bag for one night, they were like mocking the poor and the homeless
Yeah.
because
Even though it
even though
was
they were,
raised for like community projects,
yeah.
some absolute prick decided that this was really culturally offensive.
Oh, everything's offensive these days. And if you can't find something to be offended by, that you just don't count. That's what gets you currency these days on the internet. Anyway, all right, Ben, listen, enjoy your trip. I know you have to go.
Yeah,
Give us give
just
an
awesome.
update once you're there or once you're back. We'd love to hear what your experience of Melbourne and Brisbane and those places are. And have a good weekend.
Fantastic, Gareth. Thanks so much. Yeah, I'll try to be on. Otherwise, I'll send some video clips or something that you can play at any time.
Awesome. Great stuff.
Bye, guys.
All right,
Yeah.
there we go. That's Ben, and that brings us to a whole different stage of the show. We're going to talk to in a moment Kim Stevens, who's written this very, very funny book called Hold the Line, which I'm excited to talk to her about. That's coming up next. I do have to quickly remind you of a couple of things. There were some headlines earlier on. We may or may not get to some more of those in a short while. But for decades, in case you don't know this, rural children in South Africa have suffered from a debilitating condition, an estrangement from learning that causes a lifetime of struggle. And you probably don't know this if you live in a city, but rural kids, obviously, it's much further to go. It's much harder to obtain a quality education. Some of those schools have no resources whatsoever. And it's a very dire situation. But there is an NPO in Mpumalanga, which is called the Good Work Foundation, and they're providing an antidote. If you want to know more about what we're talking about here, you can listen to the latest episode of Future Impact to find out how they changed the average pass rate from 23% to 96% in 2 years. That is extraordinary. It's available wherever you get your podcasts and brought to you by Investec. Check it out also on the cliffcentral.com website. That is Future Impact, which you can go and take a listen to today. You want to know how school can change the average pass rate from 23 to 96%? You can find out how. And well done to that NPO that is helping so many school kids in Mpumalanga. It's called the Good Work Foundation. Go and find out more by listening to the podcast. So Kim Stevens is a Cape Town-based writer, a mother, and a runner. And she loves a little bit of political satire and has written this incredibly funny book where she's actually reprinted a bunch of Facebook posts that she made during lockdown. And I think there are very few people in South Africa who can't identify with some of the frustration, the anger, a lot of the humor that many of us have either banished to a part of our brains where we don't want to think about it anymore. Or if you read through it like I did yesterday, you'll look at the book and go, oh my God, I remember that. That was awful. That was horrible. That was the worst stage in my adult life to have to put up with all these crazy rules. I found myself agreeing with Kim a lot more than I thought I would through the course of this book. Kim, it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm well. Thanks very much for having me.
No, terrific work. And well done on the book.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I'm walking around naked at the moment. That's a scary thing when you put a book out.
Oh, yeah. I mean, listen, it's an easy read. Hey, I got to congratulate you on that, too. It didn't take me very look. It's an easy book to read, but it's also not a very long. We're not talking War and Peace here,
so no, you definitely probably not.
You can get through it in a day or two if you have a bit of time, and it's really really funny. But as I said a minute ago, it was funny also reading your. Is that your dog or is that your stomach?
Sorry, yes, it's my dog. I'm going to try and keep them out of here. We've got a foster puppy at the moment, and it's causing trouble. Sorry.
Don't worry. I have one that's always asking to be put on my lap, so I feel your pain. Yeah. I'm just relieved that isn't your stomach. That's all.
No, it's, although I mean, so early in the morning, it's a little bit difficult. It could have been.
So, I mentioned a moment ago when I read these Facebook posts, it kind of reminds me of a time that I'm not sure I want to be reminded of.
I know, I mean, it was a crazy time. Did you watch Tiger King?
No, I never got into that. But I did
for a while. And I was like, what are we watching? What is going on? It was a very strange time. So, I wanted to document that strange time because, I don't know, it just is a little piece of history in South Africa that had so many layers attached to it. There were so many political connotations to what we were experiencing, so many personal connotations. And there was some awful stuff going on, businesses folding and people without income and kids isolated.
No, of course.
And, you know, but there was a lot of funny stuff too. So I tried to bring humor to the situation.
So two things I completely understood and had total sympathy with, and let's just say we were in simpatico about your love for Johannesburg, which very few people are able to express a love for Johannesburg. Now, you're actually a Cape Town girl, and Cape Townians in particular never have a nice thing to say about Joburg. They think that
they
Cape
never
Town
do.
Is the,
I know.
Right? It's so weird. They always think Cape Town's the be-all and the end-all, and if someone says something horrible about Cape Town, they get hugely offended, but they don't care about Joburg. I got to thank you for that because very few people have the balls to say that, particularly Cape Townians. So nice job on that one. Also, you hate Bheki Cele, and I mean, who could love him? You must have said fuck Cele at the end of almost every second chapter of the book, which I thought.
Oh, I forgot we're on the grown up show. I can say fuck on this one. I was with the SABC on an interview the other last week, so and I've had to be nice there. But yeah, now we can actually say what the hashtag was. It was fuck Cele, and nothing about my relationship or my view of him has improved since lockdown. If anything, it's worse.
I mean, it galled me even to think back to the way he told us all we should be in bed by 9 o'clock. Do you remember that nonsense?
Like, yeah, adults, I was you're only telling grateful other adults. I was only grateful for that because I had a teenage son, and I think I, through lockdown and Kele's rules, I kind of navigated through the trickiest time of his jawling years and kept him aligned to school and rugby. So I'm only grateful for that. But otherwise, yeah, it was so patronizing. His whole, no world leader knew how to deal with the pandemic. It was foreign to everybody. There wasn't really a tried and tested way through. But he just milked it with pure ego. And it was the most patronizing display of ego I think I've seen in any politician for a very long time. It was awful.
It wasn't just politicians. I mean, if you cast your mind back to that time, neighbors were telling on each other. You had all these, that's where the word Karen came to prominence. And I don't know, sometimes I think that the word Karen might just be a pejorative. And because it's aimed at a group of people who nobody really has sympathy for, we don't treat it as such. But if you were a white middle-class woman, like being called a Karen is not exactly a compliment in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I don't think all middle-class white women are Karens, but what do you feel about the meaning of that word? And how do you feel about it even now with the benefit of hindsight?
Yeah, I suppose we've all got a little bit of Karen in us to a degree. I think sometimes it just comes from a sense of, I speak about situational blindness in the book a lot, and it's situational blindness is rife in white middle-class South Africa, having not experienced too hard a struggle, but not sort of sitting at the top echelon of earning. We kind of have this glut of the population who feels like privilege isn't something that is theirs. They don't have privilege. And they've kind of lost sight of the fact that you naturally have a degree of privilege by being white. So there's this it's not fair sense that comes through, and that's where the Karen comes in. Somebody else is getting more than she thinks is right, or she's not being served correctly, or she just loses sight of her privilege. And it's, I suppose, quite sad in a way that we have that that lack of that situational blindness that happens to so many of us in South Africa, because we live in these bubbles where we don't really understand how other communities live, and it works on all sides, not just in one way.
That's true of anyone in any place in the world. I mean, these people, it's only really people who backpack through awful, shitty third world places that really can say that they've done all of that. And usually they're the sort of people who have dirty toenails anyway. So, I mean, I'm not particularly charmed by these people who are in outreach mode the whole time, because I think very, very often they're just, they're in some way trying to unpack their own guilt over the fact that they're on holiday. And that this is their way of getting to grips with some other culture, because they think it's going to hopefully make them interesting in a life where they've been everything.
Poverty,
but
tourism stuff.
Oh, that's a big thing. You see sometimes these people who are desperate to like drive through the poorest places because it gives them a feeling. They think that we see them as being tremendously brave and intrepid and, going to explore and understand. But I think a lot of us just see straight through it and see Schadenfreude.
Definitely. Absolutely. You were chatting about Mandela Day in the clip just before this. And I think that is partially why the intention behind that day has been lost, because it became such a, for TikTok followers, I'm going to do 67 minutes of A, B, and C. And there was there's no long-term benefit to a community or a cause if you're just putting on your 67 minutes for your TikTok followers once a year. That's definitely not what Mandela or his foundation had in mind.
Well, I want to get back to your book just for a second, because you do, apart from making us laugh and making us think back to the pandemic, you also tell a very honest and very open and very tough story about your own journey. I mean, in some ways you talk about kind of privilege and you and I are probably quite lucky people in that we have a good relationship with our parents. We've had, tertiary education under the belt. I mean, if those are considered like the hallmarks of a privileged existence, then I suppose I'll claim to be a recipient of that word and all the things that are attendant to it. But you have also been through a bit of a struggle in terms of trying to figure out where you belong. You became pregnant at a very young age. You've now got three kids, am I right?
Yes, I've got three and my partner has one. So we've got a full house.
Right. And you you came out at a late stage of life, which I think is really, really interesting. Nobody really talks about this too much. And I think you explained it so beautifully when you talk about how you met Dee and how the two of you got to know each other and how you slowly and beautifully fell in love. I mean, I thought that was a really, a very well-told story, and a story told without too much of, you know, you trying to explain things. It just, it kind of just all happened very nicely. And it was nice to hear that, because you've been through a hell of a journey and you found your person. And for many people that either never happens or it happens very early in life and that is the whole story for the rest of their life. And in your case, you've really been through some amazing adventures.
Yeah, I have. And I'm very lucky to say very few regrets. I think that every person that has come through my world or passed through my world as a friend or a lover, they've been good people and we've been able to learn from each other. And I could not have predicted that in my 40s, I would finally acknowledge that a missing piece may have been that I wasn't quite as straight as my Catholic upbringing had indicated. And again, I've been so fortunate to have, I mean, I introduced Dee to my children as my girlfriend and nobody batted an eyelid. And I'm so grateful that I'm raising kids in a generation where my 13-year-old daughter talks about my husband or wife one day. And it's just not a thing. So yes, it's been amazing to fall so in love. Sorry, the dogs are crashing things around here. But to fall in love so easily.
They're going to break down your house. They're somewhere
I know,
in the course.
Only, they were so
in the course of this,
the whole morning.
Somewhere in the course of this interview, the whole thing is going to be broken down. I'm sorry, but it's I'm just pleased to hear it's not like someone who's broken into the house and trying to kill you.
No, it's a pot plant that I've now got to clean up. But that's my circus. And there's no one here to help me. Dee's at work. Otherwise, she would be holding the dogs in the bedroom or giving me backup plans here. But yes, it's been beautiful to fall easily in love. And at a time where even deep in the burbs with kids at very traditional schools, I can go to a rugby match with my girlfriend and it's not a thing. If it is a thing for somebody, they certainly haven't said so. I'm sorry.
What dogs do you have? I mean, this is just unbelievable. Whatever's going on in there, it sounds like chaos.
They were so peaceful. The cat came to the window and now they're barking at it. I've got two rescue dogs of my own and a foster puppy at the moment. So there's three of them kind of cavorting around the lounge here. And I'm sorry.
Well, the noises, my God, it sounds like you're keeping animals from a fictional story about beasts and monsters in your house. It's unbelievable. All right. So to go back to some of these questions, I mean, you know, you'd be forgiven for being angry during lockdown. A lot of us were. And you pigeonhole lots of other people, but you're very honest with yourself about how your own opinion of the lockdowns and the whole attitude towards COVID changed during the period of 2.5 years that we've all been through. How do you think you feel about it now looking back?
I think I've blocked a lot of the emotion. I definitely went into a bit of a depressive state on and off through lockdown as things got extended and extended, those hideous family meetings. And it felt like we'd never get back what we'd lost. Some of the more emotional times, my son, I don't know if you were schooled in a school that was rugby before, but he's a very talented little rugby player and he made first team for Rondebosch Boys High so last year he got his first cap and he had to run on to an empty, completely empty stadium or rugby field, you know,
all those.
And I sat in the kitchen watching the live streaming and luckily we could have access that way. But this little 7-year-old, I was just picturing this little barefoot rugby 7-year-old that was, rugby has been his passion for as long as I can remember. And there he was running on representing his school in first team kits. And there was not a single person to watch. And his dad couldn't be there. I couldn't be there. I sat on my own in the kitchen and cried and cried and watched this bizarre rite of passage playing out. Unfortunately, he's in matric this year. So we've had a full season and I've, you know, been able to go there and support every game and I haven't missed a minute. But yeah. there were lots of times in lockdown where we just felt a little robbed, I guess, all of us. Like, are we ever going to get those things back? Will I ever sit around my mother's dining room table with a full house, cousins and my sibling and our children and hug them all again? It felt like it was gone. And there was nobody that could reassure us that it was coming back. You know, it was it just felt like it was gone. So yeah, there were times where I was super angry, where I felt super alone. I was in sports marketing prior to lockdown happening, so I also had absolutely no income. And it just, yeah, it felt like so much was on hold. So there was lots of anger, there was lots of isolation and sadness, and I don't know if I'll ever take that stuff for granted again.
And now, when you look back?
Now, I've tried to see the humor, I suppose, when we look at it. I'm not one of those people who thinks that lockdown or the pandemic came along to reset the world and we all now holding hands and singing Kumbaya. I don't think it was a miracle intervention or anything like that. I think it was just a pretty awful, shitty thing that we had to navigate. And yeah, there've been some beneficial elements and work that's come out of it for me, and a book. So I guess I made the most of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think that, you know, everybody looking back on this is probably saying to themselves, never again. We're not going to take government seriously when they tell us nonsense. We're not going to believe what the medical fraternity say as if it's the science, as opposed to, you know, figuring it out for ourselves and deciding for ourselves what's right or wrong. And following these rules is just, it was so dumb. I mean, if you look back now on those, the bullshit that they told us we should wear this or we shouldn't wear that. Or you remember the family meetings on Kwasasana Dlamini Zuma telling us that this is what we're, you know, you're not allowed to go running or jogging, and if you go past people. I mean, it all came back to me, and I also got a bit pissed off reading your book yesterday, because I suddenly thought, how could we have allowed ourselves to be, and I must be honest with you, I never followed any of the rules. I didn't take any of it seriously. I could have cared less. And one of the benefits of being in a country like South Africa is you can just ignore the rules. Nobody cares. I mean, the townships didn't care, and to their credit, they got through it before anyone else.
Yeah, I think I've got mixed feelings around what was right and what was wrong. I don't have that much resentment around, I suppose, the broad rules. But within that, like banning cigarettes and stuff, that was just so blatantly political. It was gross. It was gross that everyone was going through such a tough time, and businesses were, as I said, folding, and families were separated. And then on top of that, you've got to have this greedy, very clearly politically motivated underlying bullshit that really, and South Africa just needs so much less of that.
Yeah, I also think that it's all been politicized to the extent that now, you know, people's attitudes to each other, our attitudes to disease, all of this stuff is so colored by politics now that it makes it very difficult for, you almost have to check someone out and talk to them for a little bit before you figure out, oh, okay, they're one of those people. Then once you know they're one of those people, I mean, those people on both extremes, right? You have the ones who are the conspiracy theorists who, you know, are like total crackpots who believe that this is all about, you know, implementing some kind of global world order and all of that stuff. You know, those people you have to talk to in a certain way. And then you get the ones who are like totally in Stockholm syndrome and are still wearing masks, and they're still terrified. They sanitize everything. They kind of look at people who are not wearing masks in a strange way. I mean, you've got to treat these two groups very differently. And then hopefully somewhere in the middle are the sensible people who you can be normal with.
Absolutely. And through that, through a lot of things, I suppose, that shifted and changed, I've also found I don't have the same friend group I had going into this. I found certain opinions and certain narratives, whether they be on social media or in person, got absolutely exhausting. As you said, if one was on the one extreme or on the other, I couldn't. I think we all reached a maximum with that kind of conversation where those two parties were so kind of vehement around the defense of themselves. I felt incredibly sorry for the vast majority of medical professionals. Like, imagine trying to, you've gone and studied for flipping how long, and if you specialized even longer, and then you've got these crackpots on either end taking your kind of career and making extreme opinions out of it. So ill-informed.
But that happened that happened to lawyers during the Oscar Pistorius trial, you know.
True.
I mean, everybody suddenly became a lawyer. You had people who had no understanding of law or Latin, for that matter, talking about, you know, the causal link between X and Y, or, you know, some sort of term about whether or not someone was in breach of some, I don't know, tiny stretch of the statutory law that nobody else knew about. Everyone was an expert, and this is what happens to people, is they all start to think that because they see something on TV or because they read it on social media, that they're an expert.
Yes, it is. I think everyone had some kind of medical degree or homeopathy rubbish or whatever during the pandemic.
Homeopathy. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone had some kind of solution for the pandemic that, and yeah, eventually we have got through it, and definitely lots of Stockholm syndrome left over and lots of PTSD and lots of businesses that are still battling to get themselves aligned. Hopefully we keep the work from home rule for a lot longer. I love that.
Did you do any impulse buying?
Impulse buying? No, I don't think I did.
Because I know some people who got completely addicted to online shopping during that time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. They were. In fact, one of them, who will remain nameless, has become some kind of. There's like a VIP thing inside of Takealot.com. If you order like enough stuff, they turn you into. There's a name for it. I don't even know what it is, but there's apparently this category of people who. If you've spent enough with them and you're kind of addicted to shopping on their platform, they eventually make you some kind of VIP, and then you can be guaranteed delivery within 2 days. Whereas plebs like you and me, we don't get to do that because, you know, our order will only come in like 3 weeks if we're lucky.
Yeah, that's cool. I did become completely addicted to grocery shopping online. And then after speaking about Checkers 60/60 enough in all my ramblings, eventually landed myself a copywriting job with the ad agency that has the 60/60 account. So that became my job.
Yeah, I read about that. Yeah. That's cool.
So, and I love, and those drivers are cool. They're all my mates now. They're like, hey, how are the little ones? You've been for a run yet? And in lockdown, I think that was like on some days, the only adult conversation I had.
Oh boy. Cool. Yeah. That isolation. We mustn't forget about that either. So Parallel Parking says wokeness destroyed the youth. TikTok destroyed the workforce. COVID destroyed the economy, but there's still Christmas to look forward to.
I love
Any
Christmas.
Comment on that?
I love Christmas. I'm not religious, but I absolutely love Christmas. So I'm looking forward to
it. No, me too. So you also did a bit of radio in your varsity years, right?
I went from a diploma. So I was headed to study journalism at Rhodes University and then became a mom instead. So it was a different kind of degree. And then ended up doing a PR course at Damlin in Port Elizabeth. And from that, got an internship at Algoa FM. That was just after it had privatized and was no longer part of the SABC. And I was in promotions there, and every now and then a short stint as a weather girl in the afternoon drive show with Gordon Graham. It was super fun. And then from there came to Cape Town, where I did join the SABC after a stint with United Stations, and then left radio altogether.
Well, don't worry. We both have an embarrassing SABC story. Everybody has a bit of that. I think there are people who've just watched it who feel embarrassed. So don't feel too bad.
Shame. They actually did a really cool interview with me, the morning live show. They were good. I wasn't sure what to expect because, my memories of the SABC aren't wholesome.
Well, listen, I've got to tell you, this book is fun. And for anybody who wants to remind themselves of how far we've come, take a look at Kim Stevens' book. It's called Hold the Line. It's lots of really cool anecdotes, lots of nice, interesting stories. And of course, as I said earlier, some beautiful stuff too. Your story about kind of finding out that you were pregnant and having to tell your parents when you were at varsity. The story of kind of coming out in your 40s and finding true love, and all of this it's really, really special. I loved it, Kim, and thank you.
Thank you. Gareth, can I just ask one thing before I go?
Sure.
You know I called you a prick in the book.
Well, I saw, I did see it, but you kind of, it was a bit of a throwaway comment. You said here.
I was so nervous that you were going to bring that up.
No, you were talking about how I started a game on radio called Would You Rather? And then in one of the questions, you say, I don't have a good capacity to learn a new skill, read a book past page one, or squiggle some pretty lines on paper. So I say neither. Dumb game, Gareth. Prick. I mean, I'm not insulted by that. That's cool. Thanks for including me in your book.
It's a pleasure. And I was just really worried when I got the message from my publisher that you guys wanted an interview. I'm like, but I called him a prick. She was like, just go with it.
Please.
Okay, so I'm just owning that.
Thank you so much, but don't worry about it. And if I thought that you were an awful person, I wouldn't have invited you on the show. So don't worry.
I really appreciate the interview. Thank you. And thank you for a good, honest platform.
No problem. Always good to have new people and new books, something to read. People have got to get back to reading. That's one way to cure depression, misery, isolation, and all of that stuff. So read Kim's book. It'll make you laugh. Thanks very much, Kim.
Thank you, Gareth. Keep well.
Awesome. Have a good day. Cheers. And a good weekend. Yeah, because it is Friday. The weekend looms. on the horizon. It's going to be lots of fun. And if you've got anything cool planned for the weekend, let us know. We want to hear from you. Drop us a comment. We've also got George coming in just a moment or two with some exciting stuff to tell us too. I mentioned the headlines earlier, and we've talked about that Salman Rushdie killer who read 2 pages of the Satanic Verses. Not surprised about that. I saw a great story on the news yesterday that should make South Africans feel like we're not so far behind. I've always thought that Japan is one of those countries which is way ahead of the game. You know, so many things that the Japanese do, the rest of us have yet to discover. And I know that sounds like a kind of generalized, stereotypical, trying too hard comment, but I really do find Japanese culture and society fascinating. It's something that I probably don't understand, which is why I find it so fascinating. But here's something where we're way ahead of them. And when I saw this, I had to read it twice because I wasn't sure that I was, you know, reading a fake article or a real one. So the Japanese government has decided to ask young people to drink more. You heard that right. Since the pandemic, bars and other premises selling alcohol have been hit very hard by restrictions, liquor tax revenues, that sounds familiar, and they've plummeted into the world's, obviously they're the third largest economy in the world, but they're one of the world's worst drinking countries. And this is causing the shutdown of bars, the liquor trade is falling apart. So the government has decided to launch a contest to find new ways to encourage young people to drink more. How do you like that? So for anybody who's been listening to the show for a while, feeling bad whenever we talk about, oh, you know, you're an alcoholic if you drink X, Y, and Z or if you drink at this time of day. I think it came up with one of our guests this week. Here is your solution. Go to Japan because they want you to drink more. They're actively encouraging people. They've got a competition on at the moment, and it's called the Sake Viva campaign, which is overseen by the National Tax Agency. God, I wish SARS would. Imagine if SARS launched a competition for us to drink more. SARS are paying, the Japanese equivalent of SARS are paying for this. They're inviting participants to submit ideas on how to stimulate demand among young people for alcohol. So the domestic alcoholic beverage market is shrinking due to demographic changes, such as the declining birth rate and aging population, and lifestyle changes since the pandemic. They are aiming this competition to appeal to the younger generation and revitalize the drinking industry. It includes promotional ideas for all types of Japanese alcohol, with applications open until September the 9th. Finalists will be invited to an expert consultation in October before the final tournament in Tokyo in November. They'll receive support for their plan to be commercialized, but not everyone is on board. Of course, there are some who are criticizing this, saying, are you kidding me? Staying away from alcohol, that's a good thing. Others pointed out that it seemed inappropriate for a government agency to encourage young people to drink, and it appeared the campaign had not considered health risks or sensitivity toward people dealing with alcoholism. I think this is just hilarious that the Japanese have got a massive campaign on the way to try and get young people to drink more. It's exactly the opposite of a problem we have here. I saw the liquor industry invited Becky Taylor to some conference just yesterday. So it was almost like these two things were running at the same time, and this contrast couldn't have been clearer. And you know, the minister of police got up and started shouting and screaming about how we abuse alcohol and people should be taught how to drink. I mean, like, people don't know how to drink. Becky Taylor, really. If people don't know how to drink, you're not paying attention. But you've got Japan on the one hand trying to get people to drink more. And in South Africa, you've got the government trying to get people to drink less. I just think it's all hilarious, right? Humans, pick your team. It's really crazy. Matthew says, as long as they don't encourage drunkenness. Well, yes, Matthew, I don't think that's the point. I think they're trying to get people to have good old fun. Because first of all, in Japan, they're not making enough kids. They've got too many old people, and the young people aren't having sex and having children. So they're trying to get them to do that. And sometimes alcohol is a social lubricant. So we're not talking about drunkenness. Psilocybe says, just export some of the South African unemployed people from here to there. They won't have that. You know, Japan does not allow you to become a citizen. they have a very low immigration into Japan. You have to marry a Japanese person, and even then, they don't necessarily grant you citizenship. So when we talk about immigration and emigration policies all over the world, border control, you would do well to look at Japan. They just don't have any interest in outsiders becoming citizens. Anyway, Tracy says, my mom was in the wine exporting business for 40 years. Japan used to be her biggest market by a country mile. Just relabel the bottles with paintings of the big five and a dash of gold. Sold. Well, if it's that easy, maybe we could enter the competition, Tracy. Vyasin says the Japanese government needs to send all their people to South Africa for lessons on sex and booze. Oh, yeah. I mean, it's ironic. We live in a country where we do have more young people than old, which is very good. Usually that kind of demographic is an excellent sign for the vitality and the health of a country. And we are clearly good at sex and we're good at booze, even though some people regard those two things as not being necessarily the best foot forward, so to speak. One other quick thing I wanted to throw in before we get to George. Vladimir Putin has revived an award in a similar vein to what we were talking about with Japan called a Mother Heroine Award for women who have more than 10 children. So actively, again, the Soviets during that time wanted their people to breed so that a young, young working population, because obviously people were just numbers and they wanted them to be put into service of the state. But even in Russia, post-communist USSR Russia, women with more than 10 children, according to Vladimir Putin, should receive this award called the Mother Heroine Award in an apparent attempt to alleviate the demographic crisis in his country. He has decided to bring it back. And apparently, once it comes into existence, a payment of 1 million rubles will be given to any Russian mother once their 10th child turns one, if all of them have survived. So unfortunately, Mom, if you lost two of them under the age of one, that doesn't count anymore. If all of your kids are alive and well, and your youngest one of the 10 is still going strong at their first birthday, you get 1 million rubles, which is about $16,000. So I don't know what that would be in South African rands, but it's not nothing. It's nothing to, sneeze at and ignore. Russia's population has shrunk by an average of 86,000 people per month in the latest statistics. That's just between January and May of this year, which is pretty hectic. 86,000 people a month down. In addition, they are suffering heavy losses among troops in the Ukraine, but the number of casualties has not been disclosed. Meanwhile, an estimated 73,000 immigrants have left Russia. Some citizens are fleeing the country in the light of the Ukraine war. Some are leaving because of political crackdowns, search data, immigration figures, flight information, all of those things that they've used to show this drop. But Google searches for the terms how to leave Russia in the Russian language hit a 10-year high inside the country during the invasion of Ukraine in February. That's quite scary. So a lot of people getting out. During a 30-day period in March, Australia, Turkey, and Israel were some of the top trending destinations, alongside Russia-friendly Serbia and Armenia, as well as Georgia. So people are leaving, and they're not breeding. So Putin's answer to this, well, just offer rewards so that mothers will have more kids. Why the hell not? Putin is making mothers heroines while Biden is supplying his with heroin. Oh, that's hilarious parallel parking. I think you're talking about fentanyl, but yes, I get you. Who's going to win this war? I heard that there are over 86,000 people in Japan who are over 100 years old, according to Nico. I don't know if that's true, Nico, but if it is true, that's phenomenal. I mean, we do know that the oldest people in the world, very often the record is held by a Japanese person, usually a Japanese woman. Women outlive men. Mostly the oldest person in the world is usually a woman. It hasn't been a man for a very, very long time. But here's a much, much younger man than 100-year-old, and he is here to join us every Friday to tell us about the world of motoring, the lifestyle around it, cars, the petrol price, rules on the road, weird inventions people have come up with, and he himself has pretty much piloted and driven every kind of vehicle available to humans. He is George Meany. How's it, George?
Hey, Gareth, good morning. How are
Good.
you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm good. I'm very good because I have my pilot's license back.
Oh, yay. We were waiting for this. Good.
Yes. Oh, it's
Do
like,
you think mentioning it on the show last week had anything to do with it, George?
maybe, I don't know, but I should try it more often. So, guess what I'm doing this weekend?
Yeah, flying again. Good man. So,
Yes.
all right, that's very good news. What do you have for us on the agenda today?
So, super quick, you know the tire company?
Sure.
They have partnered with a company called Disky, and now an online platform. Disky is an online platform, and you can now go into the fitment center and do your car license. There are 190 super quick stores across South Africa. Now, I wasn't sponsored to say that for super quick, but I was sponsored by the consumers out there to say that you can go and get your car license at super quick.
George, anywhere we can get our car licenses, anywhere that makes it easier, and if you can do this while you're having your tires looked at, what a win.
Exactly. So if you go and visit a super quick, you can scan the Disky QR code that's there. And when you hit send, you will get a WhatsApp and there will be a couple of prompts and you'll make payment and you can collect your disc within 5 to 10 days from that super quick or whichever super quick you choose.
Absolutely awesome. Well done to them. Good work. Anybody who can save us time and make things more efficient, we are massive fans of, whether George is sponsored by them or not.
Exactly,
All right. What
exactly.
else have you got for us?
All year for the car buying and driving consumer, which is pretty much all of us, I think.
Definitely.
I don't know if you know, Gareth, but tires in their original form were actually not black. So tires
What?
are actually this milky white color. If you go back 100 years when they first started making tires for wagons, more than 100 years, and they were predominantly white, this milky white color.
Is that the natural color of rubber, or is that
Yes.
what the is that just the color they used to have for tires? Is that
No,
what's like the
it's the
trend?
natural color of the compound rubber that they mixed
Huh.
for tires. And then scientists and researchers were looking for a substance that could make the tire last longer, to stop too much wear, to stop the abrasion on the surfaces, and to make the tire last longer. And then this substance called carbon black was developed or came about. And carbon black is actually a combustion of various petroleum products. It's the byproduct of the combustion of petroleum products. It's actually a throwaway material. And they combined this with the rubber, which then naturally made it black, and that's why our car tires are black.
I thought it was just because they started to look dirty after a while.
They are easier to clean and they hide the dirt nicely, but that's not the reason they're black, though.
Okay, well, I've sort of seen in these documentaries where they show how rubber was first farmed, how they would obtain it from these rubber trees, and it does come out of the trees. Obviously, it's this white sort of syrupy stuff, and it was apparently it always used to be a very, very difficult thing to obtain, because it's hard work, it's a tough job. It's not the kind of job everybody's lining up to do, so. There was also, obviously, there was slavery in the Congo, and a lot of this is where we started to develop the rubber trade from. So it doesn't have the greatest history, but I had no idea that it would stay that white color, and that we actually had to color it. So they put in this carbon black, and that's where our tires come up with their black color now.
Yeah, and it's predominantly because of a longevity or abrasion. The carbon black stops the tire from degrading as fast.
Okay, right. So it also performs a practical function. It's not just to look good. It's not just so it doesn't look as dirty. I really thought it was just to mask the filth of the roads.
Well, yeah, I think it's probably a dual purpose, but mainly the abrasion. So, and here's an interesting one, Gareth. Singing in your car is good for your health.
Yeah,
So,
I believe this.
first of all, when you sing, particularly in your car because it's a closed cockpit. Positive neurotransmitters, as researchers have found, get released in your brain and body. Oxytocin, serotonin. Then the second thing is singing is also good for your lungs and cardiovascular system, because guess what you have to do when you sing? You have to take deep breaths and, you know, exert yourself. So it's good for your lungs and your cardiovascular system.
I love it. I thought it was just me, but it always makes me feel better in the car when I'm driving and singing. And I do. Sometimes I have to stop myself because I'm like, if people see me doing this, they're going to think there's something wrong with me. I'm mentally ill.
Well, yeah. It takes singing in the shower to a whole new level when you're singing in the car, because, you know, you get this person next to you miming and you don't know what they're singing.
George, do you just go back to tires for a second, sure. Because there are a lot of questions about tires here in the comments, but do you spell tire with a Y or an I? I can never figure that out, and I've seen it spelled both ways, so I'm not even sure what the correct spelling is. Do you
interesting
know?
Question the tire with an I is actually an American spelling. And okay. Tire with a Y is our spelling because we come from Roman Dutch and English history.
Okay. All right. So that's answered the question then. A couple of other people. First of all, Molly Curry says, I referred a friend to Auto Trader. He phoned to inquire about a vehicle and the salesman said, sold. Goodbye. How's that? Eh?
Okay,
nice job. So this
whether
nice
that's a good or a bad thing, I'm sorry it was sold, but that's how fast it works.
Well, I think that's amazing. I mean, that's great feedback. It shows you that that what you guys are doing is happening faster and better than anyone else. Borge says, Congo Chris, I have a technical question. How do EVs measure up against diesel when it comes to torque? Are they a viable option for moving weight and pulling trailers?
Oh, a very interesting question, Congo Chris. And the answer is EVs are much better at moving things around and a talk, as you put it. There's actually a couple of videos you can go search for online. They put a EV up against a Ford F-150, the electric Ford F-150 against a regular ICE 4x4, and the EV tows that ICE right backwards.
Very, very nice. Okay, cool. Awesome. So there are a couple of questions answered. You see, George, we need you here on a Friday. Otherwise, people sit around pondering these things for week after week. Thank God we got you to ask. What else you got for us?
So carrying on with the singing, very lastly, singing increases a substance called, and I'm going to try and say this, immunoglobulin in your saliva.
Immunoglobulin.
Yeah. Immunoglobulin. There we go. You see, so I couldn't even.
Cool.
And at the same time reduces cortisol. So if you reduce cortisol and you increase immunoglobulin in your saliva, your body can ward off illness a little bit better. So singing in your car is a really, really good thing. And then finally, I'm very interested in this one, and that is why.
Do you have any recommendations about what we should be singing in the car, George? What songs are guaranteed to make us feel better?
Whatever comes to mind. I mean, if it's from The Hills Are Alive to Metallica, you know, sing your heart out.
All right.
and then very lastly, Gareth, why are cars designed to go over the speed limit?
Because you want to know that you're driving some kind of invention that has an upper limit. You want to see how far they've pushed the technology. You want to know that you're driving something that has performance built into it. It's not about just following stupid traffic rules.
Exactly. So a lot of what you said there is very true. And we went and dug to see what the reason is that a car can do 200 kilometers an hour when the speed limit is only 120. Yeah. So most of the answer is emergencies. That's the answer that comes up a lot, but it's not the only answer. So the technical answer is when top speed increases, typically quicker acceleration is also a feature of the car.
Right.
So in order to get quicker acceleration and efficient acceleration, you have to have a car that can go faster than the speed limit generally. And then faster cars are also designed with better dynamics and cornering abilities, because the car manufacturer and designer has to design the car to be able to drive at the speed that that it can attain.
Right.
It's got better cornering and dynamic abilities.
But also the stupid rules come in after the car. The car doesn't come into existence with the rules already in place. So that's the true. Car was there first. It's a chicken and egg situation. The car was there first. People have always wanted to see how fast a car can go. That's why there are still people building, you know, cars that can break the land speed record and planes that can fly faster than any other plane. We want to see how far our ingenuity can take us. And then we invent these rules so that we can all live peacefully together and cause as little damage to each other as possible. But you can't have the one before the other.
Exactly. That's also very true. Not in my list, but Gareth raises a good point.
There's one other thing though. So I've got to ask you about this because I was lying in bed two nights ago and I heard these guys like dicing cars on the road outside where I live, like really fast at like midnight or whatever it was. And these cars are super loud and clearly law enforcement have just got no interest in stopping this kind of thing. Is that something that happens all over the country, or is it something that people are now getting away with that they didn't get away with before? Do you know anything about these guys who like drive really, really fast with very loud cars late at night on open stretches of road?
Yeah, so there for decades already, there has been illegal street racing, which is frowned upon, and you know, even I frown upon it, because if you visit these illegal street races, oftentimes the people are standing right next to the road, and oftentimes the cars that are in these illegal street races can't be handled by the driver. And then can cause some serious injury to the human being standing on the side. And then very often alcohol is involved. And so it's a very uncontrolled environment. So if that is happening around your area, these illegal street races, they're quite often underground. They move around from place to place. And law enforcement have been trying to clamp down on them for 2-3 decades. Because it does happen. It does happen late at night, and it happens randomly. So where people get together with their fast cars.
Yeah, I've seen those. I'm sure you have too. Those videos of people who've lost control of their car on some stretch of highway where they think, you know, nobody. And there are these crowds that gather to watch this stuff actually. And these people spin out of control, and they can either kill bunches of people in the crowd, or they wipe themselves out. Which is never really a bad thing if they're just wiping themselves out. But of course, their car lies all over the road. And the next day when people need to use that road, it first needs to be cleared up.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, a couple of organizations have tried to put together drag strip organized racing, you know, and that has curbed it to a certain degree, but it's still a problem.
All right. Sorry, I just had to ask about that because it was on my mind from two nights ago. But thank you, George.
Good question.
Yeah. As always, lots of interaction from everybody else. People love it. Thank you very much. With another episode of the Auto Trader podcast coming up this week. Don't miss George and the rest of the crew. All right. Have a lovely weekend. CliffCentral.com.